On the second Sunday in Advent, we light the peace candle. This is a reflection on the biblical meaning of peace and the place of peace in my own life. Today's reading from the Hebrew Bible includes the words of 2 Isaiah, a prophet called by God to speak to the people of Israel after they had been defeated by the Chaldeans, their temples destroyed, and their leadership deported into Babylon captivity for over 50 years. Despair, guilt, and hopelessness were everywhere. Then comes these words, this watershed in the history of Israel. Speaking through Isaiah, God shatters their forlorn worldview with a soaring new vision of hope, consolation, and peace. His words mark a turning point in Jewish history, where they abandon a theology of judgment for a theology of consolation, salvation, and forgiveness. So dramatic is this moment. It makes sense then that this passage has been paired in the lectionary with a gospel text taken from the opening of the book of Mark, the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ. When Mark wrote his first gospel, and this is the very first time in written faith history that the word gospel appears, the good news. When this happened, Rome was a massive military power. The Jews were being oppressed and had begun to rebel. The Second Temple was about to be destroyed, and the Christians were persecuted under the thumb of this powerful oppressor, who was presented to them not only as a king, but as a divine being. Once again, fear and despair consumed the people. But at this turning point in history, God, as before, breaks in with this ultimate promise of salvation in the person of ironic royalty, the Prince of Peace. Shalom is the Hebrew word for peace. Its root denotes wholeness or completeness, and throughout Jewish literature is bound up with a notion of perfection, a blessing of things as God intended them. Thus, you see, shalom isn't limited to the absence of war or even the absence of strife. As Anitra was saying when she talked to the children, she expanded the definition. Although these things, this absence of strife and violence, are arterial to it, shalom is a wide-ranging moral and ethical concept that can refer to the end of violence, but also to personal and communal well-being and the presence of justice and tranquility and prosperity and security. Understanding this idea of peace is the obligation of the faithful to work tirelessly for its establishment. You can't just say that you're for peace if you aren't actively working for it. Shalom is communal, not private. There is no separate peace. As long as homelessness, hunger, violence, and hatred exist, shalom remains at a distance. To be faithful is to be, as St. Francis once prayed, an instrument of peace. For Christians, the coming of the Prince of Peace is the defining act of a graceful God inviting us to shalom, to be these instruments. Of course, being sober realists that we are, and knowing that our world is filled with wars and threats of war and violence and hate and harassment every day, shalom seems in short supply. But rather than be immobilized by these things or reduced to cynicism, we are called through our faith by Christ to be something more noble. And so we search. We search for a pathway and a guide through this despairing moral morass. These guides, these shining lights, seem to be in short supply. But every now and then, we are buoyed up and sustained by real moral heroes and sheroes who are shining a light in the darkness. Martin Luther King was one of those lights. He labored for what he called the establishment of the beloved community. It was his idea of shalom, and for him, it was the goal of nonviolence. It was a place of reconciliation and redemption in our society. And while he shared his dream of its attainment with us, he knew it was a work in progress. But despite the setbacks that came to him and the movement that he led, tragedies and disappointments that came to him, he dedicated his life to achieving it. He became an instrument of peace. In May of 1964, I was a high school junior, and I had been invited to attend a national religious convention in Atlantic City. I was asked to speak about leadership and church programs for teenagers. It was the first time I had ever spoken to that many people, probably more than 1,000. I was scared to death. I was so nervous. I was really obsessed with my 7-minute speech, and I kept reading it over and over, and I had my head buried in my speech as I waited for the moment to arrive. The schedule of the speakers had drawn on, and everything had been delayed, and so I had a little more time to read over my speech. I never realized that it was right before Martin Luther King was scheduled to speak, one of the greatest orators in the history of America. He was receiving a prestigious peace award. The program was running late, and standing in the wings, reading over my text one more time, I looked up and was startled to see right in front of me Dr. King. I was awestruck. I didn't have any words. He introduced himself and then asked me about my speech. I was embarrassed, fumbled, and confused. I said that I wished that I could be as confident a speaker as he was. And then I blurted out, I don't know why, I just blurted out, "It took me forever to write this speech, Dr. King. You are so busy and travel so much. How do you ever find the time to write yours?" He smiled knowingly and replied, "I'm terribly busy, you're right. Much more than I'd like. But you see, I have been getting ready to make these speeches all my life. Good speeches are born from years, not minutes or hours. They are testimony. They come from your heart and soul, not your head." Right then, while I was trying to drink that in and decide if his words were good news or bad news for a teenager who hadn't had much of a life to put into his speech, I was called onto stage. Bewildered by what had just happened to me, I did as well as I could. and was very grateful to be speaking before him rather than after him. Afterwards, backstage, I paused to listen to his eloquence, his testimony, and reflected for a brief moment on what an amazing human being he was and what a privilege it was for me to meet him. But quickly, I was whisked away by the stage manager just as King was finishing, and I never met him again. His words, however, have lingered in my head for years. Now, when people ask me what inspired me to enter the ministry, I always include Dr. King in my answer. He was, for me, not just an inspiration for good public speaking, but an inspiration for trying to give my life real meaning, a life that would give authenticity and substance to anything I might ever have to say. He inspired me to fight for justice, to become a pacifist, to protest the death penalty, and fight against nuclear weapons. I, too, wanted to work toward that beloved community. I yearned to be an instrument of peace. I knew I would never measure up to the standard King set, but I wanted to try. In the late 1970s, I was the pastor of a local church. I got involved in a peace movement that was advocating for a halt to the testing and deployment of nuclear weapons, the nuclear freeze. I joined a local group of Quakers in Massachusetts. The Quakers are always first at these things. And before long, they surprised me and elected me to the state group, who in turn elected me to the national group. And to my amazement, 2 years later, I became the national leader of that movement of millions of people, probably the largest grassroots peace and justice organization in American history. It catapulted me, a local pastor, onto a national and international stage. 21 years after my brief but life-changing encounter with Dr. King, I found myself in Geneva, Switzerland, at the first Reagan-Gorbachev summit, in the company of a small group of activists who, after a great deal of lobbying and negotiation, found ourselves face-to-face with a Russian leader, Mikhail Gorbachev. I had no written speech that day, but the words came easily as I talked with Premier Gorbachev and then presented him with 40 cartons containing more than 1 million petition signatures calling for a halt and a moratorium in nuclear weapons testing. We earnestly desire it, but somewhere deep inside we doubt that we can make a real difference in the world. I know I did. I wasn't someone famous. I wasn't a scientist or a corporate wheeler dealer. I was just a pastor of a local church. But believing in the gospel of Jesus Christ and in the command of Shalom that I could not keep my peace private, I did what I could. I hope Dr. King would have been proud of me. Advent is a time when we once again hail the coming of the Prince of Peace. It's also the time of year we remember December 7th and the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, which led this nation into World War II and demanded the greatest sacrifice of our nation, the deadliest war in history. Over 60 million people were killed. That war ended with the dropping of nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing over 200,000 people. Sadly, that horror has faded from view, its lessons seemingly lost, and 70 years later, we're facing the threat of another nuclear holocaust as two adolescent leaders play chicken with civilization.
The good news is that today, we say it's good news, there are about half as many nukes as there were 40 years ago. The bad news is that the ones we have are nearly 10 times more powerful, and that 9 countries have them, and soon perhaps 10. William Sloan Coffin once said that the Cold War was devastating to warm hearts. In it, the divine commandment to love your enemy was changed to the imperative to hate all commies. Hate became a patriotic virtue. We became more and more ignorant of the things of which we were most assured. And tragically, his words are just as relevant today as they were 40 years ago. Once again, hate is defining our national identity. Whether it's Muslims or Iranians or Palestinians or North Koreans, or here at home, simply those who love differently, our only mode of engagement is fear and hatred. We hate, and we're hated. And of course, then we hate those who hate us. And as unfettered hate grows, violence looms larger with each word of hate, each act of hate. It has been said that life hangs on an ethical hinge. If we loosen that hinge, what falls will be of historic proportions. Just because we can do something physically doesn't mean that we are justified morally. Without a moral compass, life has no bearing, no perspective, and we end up wandering in the darkness and blind to the consequences of what we do. Dr. King once said, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." Advent is the end breaking of the reign of love and peace, God's shalom. But that shalom isn't a sentimental commemoration of something that we can simply sit back, send a few cards, sing a few carols, and observe. If the radical message of God's love incarnate in the babe of Bethlehem is to have any meaning at all, it must be alive in us, heart and soul. We must set our feet on lofty places. We must be instruments of God's peace. It is through us that the rough places of human interaction will be made plain. It is through us that the mountains of prejudice and hate will be brought low. It is through us that love will overthrow misguided power and arrogance. It is through us that the hungry will be fed and the homeless housed. It is through us that the broken spirits will be made whole and the sin-sick soul will find its balm. It is through us that the glory of God will be revealed. Regardless of our shortcomings, regardless of our self-doubt, regardless of our position in life, no matter if we think we are of little consequence, the message of Christmas, of the child born in the manger, is that if we are faithful to him, you and I can be builders of the beloved community. We can be agents of concord. We can be instruments of peace. Amen.